Face the Nation, coming up next.
Guys, if you're into fantasy football, you've got to check out FanDuel.com. At FanDuel, you play in one-week fantasy football leagues for real money with immediate cash payouts. You only play when you want, and you can change your team any week. FanDuel's paying out over $10 million every week this season. And right now, FanDuel is giving you up to $200 free. That's right. For every dollar you deposit, FanDuel will match it up to $200. Just go to FanDuel.com, click the microphone in the upper right corner, and enter code FOOTBALL70. FANDUEL.com. Code FOOTBALL, the number 70.
I'm Bob Schieffer, and today on Face the Nation, the president makes the case for war.
Part of our solution here is going to be military. We just have to push them back.
We'll preview Steve Croft's 60 Minutes interview with the president and hear his plan to turn back the new terrorist threats. We'll hear from Virginia's Democratic Senator Tim Kaine, who says Congress has given too much authority to the president. We'll get the latest on the mission and what it entails from Deputy National Security Advisor Antony Blinken, retired General Carter Ham, former Pentagon official Michelle Flournoy, and former Deputy Director of the CIA Mike Morrell. Plus, an all-star panel for analysis. 60 years of news, because this is Face the Nation. In the interview with Steve Croft of 60 Minutes, President Obama revealed new details on how the terror group ISIS used the chaos and confusion of the Syrian civil war to rebuild its own force, and why he concluded that the new U.S. strategy had to include a military component. Here's part of the interview.
How did they end up where they are in control of so much territory? Was that a complete surprise to you?
Well, I think our head of the intelligence community, Jim Clapper, has acknowledged that I think they underestimated what had been taking place in Syria. Essentially, what happened with ISIL was that you had al-Qaeda in Iraq, which was a vicious group, but our Marines were able to quash with the help of Sunni tribes. They went back underground. But over the past couple of years, during the chaos of the Syrian civil war, where essentially you have huge swaths of the country that are completely ungoverned, they were able to reconstitute themselves and take advantage of that chaos and attract foreign fighters who believed in their jihadist nonsense and traveled everywhere from Europe to the United States to Australia to other parts of the Muslim world, converging on Syria. And so this became ground zero for jihadists around the world. And they've been very savvy in terms of their social media. In some cases, you have old remnants of Saddam Hussein's military that had been expunged from the Iraqi military, which gave them some traditional military capacity and not just terrorist capacity. And this is one of the challenges that we're going to have generally, is where you've got states that are failing or in the midst of civil war, these kinds of organizations thrive. That's why it's so important for us to recognize part of our solution here is going to be military. We just have to push them back and shrink their space and go after their command and control and their capacity and their weapons and their fueling and cut off their financing and work to eliminate the flow of foreign fighters. But what we also have to do is we have to come up with political solutions in Iraq and Syria in particular, but in the Middle East generally, that arise at an accommodation between Sunni and Shia populations that right now are the biggest cause of conflict, not just in the Middle East, but in the world.
You mentioned James Clapper, the Director of National Intelligence. I mean, he didn't just say that we underestimated ISIL. He said we overestimated the ability and the will of our allies, the Iraqi army, to fight.
That's true. That's absolutely true.
And more of Steve Croft's interview with the president can be seen on tonight's 60 Minutes after football. An international coalition led by the United States continued attacks in Iraq and Syria this weekend. CBS News correspondent Holly Williams and her team have made their way to Erbil in northern Iraq. Holly.
Good morning, Bob. More than 150,000 people have fled ISIS over the last week and a half. after the Islamic militants tightened their siege of the town of Kobani in northern Syria. Now, those people certainly welcome the US-led airstrikes, but they've told us they need more of them. It's very similar to what we're told here in Iraqi Kurdistan, where they're fighting against ISIS on the ground. They welcome US help, they just need more of it. Now, the airstrikes so far have targeted things like ISIS vehicles, barracks, training facilities, and the oil fields that ISIS controls. And they will degrade the strength of ISIS. But destroying ISIS is another matter entirely, and it may be impossible from the air because the Islamic extremists are entrenched in towns and cities. And airstrikes on those areas will kill many more civilians, which the US and its coalition partners certainly want to avoid.
Holly, do you think these airstrikes are welcomed by everyone there?
No, they're not. ISIS has popular support amongst some Sunni Muslims in Syria and Iraq, including in cities like Raqqa and Mosul. And the strikes haven't just been against ISIS. They've also targeted a group that is linked to the Al-Nusra Front, which is very popular with Syrians who are opposed to the regime and has even fought alongside the so-called moderate rebels who are backed by the US. Now, Al-Nusra has called on its supporters to attack the US and other coalition partners in retaliation. And many ordinary Syrians are outraged that the US would launch strikes against Al-Nusra while it's failed to take any military action at all against the Syrian regime, which has been indiscriminately bombing its own people for more than 3 years. Bob?
Thank you so much, Holly, and be safe.
Guys, if you're into fantasy football, you've got to check out FanDuel.com. At FanDuel, you play in one-week fantasy football leagues for real money with immediate cash payouts. You only play when you want, and you can change your team any week. FanDuel's paying out over $10 million every week this season. And right now, FanDuel is giving you up to $200 free. That's right. For every dollar you deposit, FanDuel will match it up to $200. Just go to FanDuel.com, click the microphone in the upper right corner, and enter code FOOTBALL70. FANDUEL.com. Code FOOTBALL, the number 70.
We turn now to Antony Blinken. He is the president's deputy national security advisor. Mr. Blinken, as the president sort of succinctly outlined it, and as you just heard from Holly Williams, this is an extremely complicated situation.
It is, Bob, but we have a comprehensive strategy to deal with it. You've seen the president put together a broad international coalition. We had five Arab countries flying with us the other day. We have more than 50 countries now part of this effort, not only dealing with the situation on the ground, but also trying to stop the flow of foreign fighters, stop the financing, delegitimize ISIL. It's a comprehensive campaign, and it has a broad coalition. It's going to take time, but we now have the pieces in place to do it.
How do you feel it's going so far?
Well, I think we've had a very good start. You saw, again, the president proceeded very deliberately, as well as decisively. We wanted to get an inclusive Iraqi government in place so we'd have a partner to work with in Iraq. We wanted to get support to train and equip the Syrian opposition, and we had a broad bipartisan vote in support of that in Congress, and this broad coalition with more than 50 countries. And the first night in Syria, having five Arabs flying with us is a very significant development.
What do you think was the tipping point for the president on this? I mean, this does represent a different way of thinking, it seems to me. What caused him to finally say, you know, we've got to go out after these guys? They don't understand anything but force.
Bob, you know, actually, there's a very strong continuum in the president's approach to this, and that is he's been relentless about dealing with terrorism wherever it emerges. And that goes back to before he was president, when he said he would go after bin Laden in Pakistan, even if the Pakistanis didn't want us to. So wherever it's emerged, we've dealt with it. Core al-Qaeda in Afghanistan and Pakistan has been decimated, but the problem has moved elsewhere. But this is a very different approach than what was taken in the past. It's not tens of thousands or hundreds of thousands of American ground forces. It's not trillions of American dollars. It's helping local forces with some of the unique things we have, air power, training and equipping them, assisting them. And it's getting a broad coalition together. And it's not falling into the al-Qaeda trap of putting tens of thousands of Americans on the ground to be bogged down and bled.
Speaker Boehner told ABC this morning that although the president has the authority for military action in Syria, he says he will bring Congress back to vote on it if the president wants him to do that. Does the president want him to do that?
We would welcome Congress's support. We've already have it for the Train and Equip program, and that support can manifest itself in different ways, including a new authorization to use force. So that's something we'd welcome. We don't require it. We have the existing authorization from 2001. That's a basis for proceeding, but we'd certainly welcome Congress showing its support.
He also said this morning that if other nations don't step up and put ground troops into Syria, his quote, we have no other choice.
We've been very clear that there will not be a U.S. ground invasion of Iraq or Syria. This has to be local forces stepping up and fighting for their own country. What we can do, what we are doing, is to provide some of these unique assets that we have, including air power. But they have to be the ones doing the fighting on the ground. Again, we're not going to repeat what we did before. Hundreds of thousands of Americans on the ground in the Middle East getting bogged down. That's exactly what Al-Qaeda wants. That's not what we're going to do.
We also hear reports that the administration may be considering a no-fly zone in Syria. Is that a possibility?
We're looking at different things as this campaign moves forward. But in the first instance, what we're looking at and what we're doing is setting back ISIL in Iraq and also in Syria, moving them from their toes to their heels, getting them thinking about protecting themselves instead of killing other people and taking territory. And as we're doing that, building up our local partners. And so other ideas that may come into play down the line, we're looking at all of that. But right now, we're setting ISIL back.
All right. Mr. Blinken, thank you so much
Thanks, Bob,
for joining us. We really appreciate it. And joining us now from the state capitol in Richmond is Virginia Democratic Senator Tim Kaine. Senator Kaine, thank you for coming.
Good morning, Bob.
As I understand it, it's not that you disagree with what the president is doing now, but you think Congress should go on record and vote on this and put some end date to this operation, however it turns out. Am I summarizing your view correctly?
Bob, you state it correctly. I think the president's definition of the mission has been careful, and that's why I've introduced an authorization to essentially authorize the mission as he described it with some key limitations. And I also think the administration has done a great job of bringing together the multinational coalition. But we're not supposed to start a war without Congress. I'm sitting in the Capitol that Thomas Jefferson designed here in Virginia. He, James Madison, George Mason, and others who participated in the drafting of the Constitution made a critical break from previous history where war was a matter for the monarch or the executive and said that war should not be started without Congress. The reason they did it? We shouldn't be putting our servicemen and women in harm's way if there's not a political consensus that the mission is worth it. So I think the president's assertion that he can do this, I think he does not have the Article II constitutional authority to do this entire mission without Congress, and neither of the authorizations passed by Congress in 2001 or 2002 cover it. We should be debating and voting on this entire mission.
Well, how detailed and what exactly do you want the Congress to vote on? What would be included in this resolution if it to be what you want?
Bob, the resolution that I've introduced, and some other members have introduced similar resolutions, basically tracks the president's four-point plan. Humanitarian aid, of course, that's not controversial, and the U.S. is the biggest provider of humanitarian aid in the world to Syrian refugees. Airstrikes in Iraq and Syria, counterterrorism operations to go after ISIL leadership wherever they are, and in addition, the training and assisting of ground forces, whether it's the Iraqi security force, the Peshmerga in the Kurdish area, or vetted opposition in Syria. So that is what we propose. And then there are some key limitations. I include a sunset where the president would have to come back and keep Congress informed to extend the mission beyond a year, a limitation on ground forces, a repeal of the 2002 Iraq authorization so we don't have dueling authorizations out there, and a careful definition of who the target is. The notion of kind of we can go after people who perpetrated 9/11 and it's now being used to go after groups that didn't even exist when 9/11 happened suggests we've got to be very careful in how we define who we are at war with.
You know, so far at least, you're sort of a lone voice. I know there are some others that agree with you. But the majority of Congress seemed just delighted to be able to get out of town and not have to go on record on this. What do you think about that?
Bob, it really concerns me that the president would assert he has the ability to do this unilaterally when, as a candidate for president, he made very plain that the president cannot unilaterally start a war without Congress. He was very clear about that. But you're right. To the extent that there's some culpability here, it probably is more on Congress's shoulders. We adjourned on the 18th of September. That's the second earliest recess before a midterm since 1960. And you know what? If the president had asked us to stay, like David Cameron asked Parliament to come back, we would have. And the vote that Congress passed on the one piece of it that we voted on, the training of Syrian opposition, showed strong bipartisan support in both houses, we could have given the president, and more importantly, we could have given our servicemen and women the strong backing of our political class before we ask them to risk their lives in what could be a very extended mission.
All right. Well, Senator, we want to thank you very much for being with us this morning. We'll be back in one minute to talk to our panel of experts. We want to bring in our first panel for some analysis. Michelle Flournoy was the number three person at the Pentagon earlier in the Obama administration. She now heads up the Center for New American Security. General Carter Hamm, the former commander of the multinational brigade in Mosul and more recently head of the U.S. Africa Command. And Mike Morrell, who was number two at the CIA. He is now a CBS contributor. And Mike, I want to start with you first. There was a report that we had gotten the head of Khorasan, this new, heretofore unheard-of group of terrorists who has suddenly sprung up. But so far, there's been no confirmation of that. Do you have any information on that?
No, I don't. I think if he had been killed, we would know by now. I think the bigger question is this group was planning a very specific attack to bring down an airliner using some very sophisticated explosives. The question is, have we disrupted that? The answer is, we really don't know yet. Sometimes you get intelligence that you've disrupted such a plot. Sometimes you don't. But, Bob, I'll tell you, in my 4 years of serving as deputy director, we probably went through this 10 times where we had a specific plot. The president took action both to increase our defenses and to go after the terrorists. In every case, we disrupted it.
General Hamm, I want to ask you, from a military standpoint, how effective do you think this campaign has been so far?
Well, it's clear that the airstrikes to date have halted the advance of ISIL and certainly caused them to change the openness that they have been operating under. The next phase will be much more difficult. As ISIL forces blend into the cities and into civilian populations, identifying and targeting them will become increasingly difficult.
Michelle Flournoy, you were at the Pentagon for a while. You worked for President Obama. You were at the very, among the top policy people there. I asked this question to Tony Blinken just now, but I want to ask you, what do you think was the tipping point for the president on this? Because this represents a fairly different way of thinking, it seems to me, when he decided to go into Syria here. What did it? What caused him to say, I got to do this?
I think it was a number of things. I think it was the spilling over of the ISIL threat into Iraq and with a speed and success that I think surprised everyone. I think it was the flow of foreign fighters, the fact that you had thousands of people coming in to Syria to wage jihad who had Western passports, who could come back to Europe or the United States without having to get visas. And then I think ultimately it was the beheading of the American journalists and the fact that that brought it home to Americans in their living rooms watching the news. So I think those things combined to give him a sense he had to act.
What's your sense of that, General?
I would agree with Secretary Flournoy. I think it was this compilation of events that unfolded and a recognition that ISIL presents a different kind of threat than one we have faced before, and that military action was required, but only as one component of a much broader ranging overarching strategy.
Mike, what do you think?
I think it's two things. One is it's the threat that they pose to the homeland today, and the significant threat they could pose down the road. But it's also the fact that they pose a significant threat to the stability of the whole region. The failure of Iraq as a state, the possible failure of Syria as a state, and what that would mean for the whole region. I think you put those two things together, it forced him to act.
I thought the president, it was very interesting to hear him say that it was this chaos created by the Syrian civil war, that ISIS was sort of operating under under the radar there. And that's how they were able to reinforce and rebuild their forces and emerge as a threat. What's your sense of that, General?
I think that's certainly partly true. We don't have great visibility, did not have great visibility into what was going on inside Syria. And to a degree, post the U.S. drawdown in Iraq, didn't have eyes and people in force on the ground in northern Iraq to detect that this situation was evolving.
Ms. Flournoy, who do you think is the most influential advisor in the president's circle right now?
You know, I think he hears from a number of key people, certainly his national security advisor, but also I think Secretary of State Kerry is very important, as are General Dempsey and a number of his military advisors. In my experience, this is a president who hears all points of view and weighs those. But I think, you know, the most important thing here has been the putting together of this coalition, because this coalition will actually not only help us fight ISIL, but also get some to our larger objectives in the Middle East.
Yes, Mike.
I just wanted to say something about this coalition, because I think it is very important that we've got so many countries working together. But there's something that happened a couple days ago that I want to mention about the coalition. You know, many Americans don't believe there's such thing as moderate Muslims. But a couple days ago, we had an Emirati pilot, a female Emirati pilot, flying in a fighter jet over Syria, dropping weapons on ISIS. And it's great symbolism that there are moderate Arab states.
General, what is the problem going to be ahead? I mean, everybody we hear says, you know, you can't get this done without some sort of ground combat troops in there. Do you agree with that?
I do. Ground forces will be required to dislodge ISIL from the towns, villages, and the large city of Mosul that they control. The question remains, will it necessarily be Western ground forces? And that has yet to play out.
Mr. Flournoy, will the Iraqis ever get their act together here? Do you see them as a viable ground force here?
I think they will likely get their act together with our help. I think having our special operators in there, our intelligence officers, and most importantly, having a new government that will be more inclusive of the Sunni population, that's the key to the cohesion of the force.
All right, we're going to take a break here. We're going to ask you to stick around for part two of our broadcast, and I'll be back in a moment with some personal thoughts. Some will say the president made a wrong turn. Some, and I am one of them, believe it was the right way to go. Reality is not always to our liking, but it is reality. The president's decision to go after ISIS was a recognition that the war on terror is not over and won't be over until the terrorists say it's over, which they will never do, and which is why they must be destroyed. Some will criticize the president for being too slow to act. And I do believe he should have acted more quickly. But reluctance to put American lives on the line until absolutely necessary is not a bad thing. Critics on the other side will argue he's taking us into another war when he campaigned to take us out of war. I have said before that we went to Iraq for the wrong reasons and left in the wrong way. But that was then, and this is now. No one wants more war, but we can't pick and choose when to confront threats to our national security. We do that when the threat emerges. Last week was a turning point for the administration, but to my mind, the president had no choice but to do what he did. Back in a minute.
Guys, if you're into fantasy football, you've got to check out FanDuel.com. At FanDuel, you play in one-week fantasy football leagues for real money with immediate cash payouts. You only play when you want, and you can change your team any week. FanDuel's paying out over $10 million every week this season. And right now, FanDuel is giving you up to $200 free. That's right. For every dollar you deposit, FanDuel will match it up to $200. Just go to FanDuel.com, click the microphone in the upper right corner, and enter code FOOTBALL70. FANDUEL.com. Code FOOTBALL70.
And welcome back to Face the Nation, back with our panel, Michelle Flournoy, former Defense Undersecretary, now at the Center for New American Security, Army General Carter Hamm, who led the multinational brigade in Mosul, and Mike Morrell, the former number two at the CIA. General, let me ask you, we keep hearing reports of setting up a no-fly zone in northern Syria. Is that a good idea, and what does that entail?
I worry sometimes that when people say impose a no-fly zone, there's this almost antiseptic view of this as an easily accomplished military task. It's extraordinarily difficult. Having overseen imposing a no-fly zone in Libya, a force that is vastly inferior in the air forces and air defenses to that which exists in Syria, it's a pretty high-risk operation. It can do it. Certainly the Air Force, the United States Air Force, and the aviation components of the Navy and the Marine Corps, the best in the world, unmatched. And they can do it, but it drives the risk up pretty high.
Well, what does it entail?
It first entails, we should make no bones about it, it first entails killing a lot of people and destroying the Syrian air defenses and those people who are manning those systems. And then it entails destroying the Syrian Air Force, preferably on the ground, in the air if necessary. This is a violent combat action that results in lots of casualties and increased risk to our own personnel.
Well, what about this whole idea? Bob Kagan, who writes a lot on security matters, said last week that we ought to disable the Syrian Air Force, bomb all their runways, and just keep their Air Force on the ground. How does that strike you, Ms. Flournoy?
You know, I think that would be a significant escalation and a real broadening of the objectives that the president's defined. Right now, we're focused on beating back ISIL, not entering into the Syrian civil war. So I think that is something that, you know, needs to be seriously debated before we go down that road.
And Mike, the whole idea, I mean, we kind of get to talking mostly about tactics, really, when you come back, tactical decisions, go after the, you know, anti-aircraft units or trucks on the ground. How does this new strategy that the president has outlined give us a broader overview of where we are on this and where we're going?
Bob, this is not the first time that an Islamic extremist group has taken territory. Some people think it is. It's not. Al-Shabaab had territory in Somalia. They still do. AQIM, which is an Al-Qaeda group in North Africa, took a tremendous amount of territory in Mali. AQAP in Yemen took almost a third of that country before it was taken back by the Yemeni military. So this is the fourth time it's happened. I think we're going to see this kind of situation more and more in the future across the whole swath of geography where we see Al-Qaeda today. So next 5 years, 10 years, 15 years, we're going to see Islamic extremist group take territory, and we're going to have to figure out in each case how to take it back.
Let me just go around the table here. The president, the new strategy, do you think it's a good idea? Do you have problems with it? How would you sum it up in your feelings about it?
I agree with Michelle. I think the strategy is very strong in Iraq. I think we're going to see success there. The strategy is weaker in Syria because we don't have a strong army on the ground to work with.
All right. Michelle?
I would agree with that. And the other thing I would say is that I think we need to set expectations that this is going to take years to execute. We're not going to see easier quick wins. This is a matter of patience and perseverance to be successful.
General. I'd agree with Mike that says that Iraq's a little bit easier than Syria. Remains to be seen if the Iraqi military can get their act together with assistance and advising to accomplish the necessary tasks on the ground.
All right. Well, thank you all very much for helping us with this morning. And we'll be back with our reporter roundtable to talk about the president's new way forward and the rest of the news.
No God condones this terror. No grievance justifies these actions. There can be no reasoning, no negotiation with this brand of evil. The only language understood by killers like this is the language of force. So the United States of America will work with a broad coalition to dismantle this network of death.
And now to get a whole new take on all of this, our reporter roundtable, Kim Strassel of the Wall Street Journal, Peter Baker, White House correspondent for the New York Times, Michael Gerson of the Washington Post, Ruth Marcus also with the Washington Post, and Michael Crowley, the deputy Washington bureau chief for Time magazine. Well, Kim, give me your thoughts on the events of this week, because I see this week as kind of a turning point.
It is. It's always good to have a president who has a plan rather than not. So, yay on that. And he gave a very good speech at the UN, and I think has also been very careful what we saw Mr. Blinken saying, too, of not putting a timeline on this, which is better than what we've had in the past, and that he's actually, I think, gearing up America for the understanding that this is going to take a while. I do nonetheless think that there are some real problems, though, that we still face, one of which is that, yes, we're going in with allies. Many of those are allies who are still very distrustful of us, given his walk back on the Syrian red line in the past. I think the scope of the mission is still not necessarily big enough to get done what needs to get done, and that includes taking out Assad in Syria. And I think this promise on ground troops, no ground troops, is going to come back and be a problem for the president and for our ability to succeed.
Peter Baker, you cover the White House. What do you, I've asked this question about three times this morning, but I'm going to ask you too. What do you think was the tipping point for this president?
Yeah, no, it's a great question, because I do think we see, especially in this last week, as Kim was saying, a different approach. And I know Tony Blinken wanted to tell us how consistent this was, and you can certainly make that argument, but this does not feel like a president who's leading from behind. He is taking ownership of this campaign. He is, in fact, putting the American troops in the front, even as he's talking about the coalition. And he's speaking about it in repeated ways in public, in a way he really didn't do in past foreign policy crises, where he kind of would give a speech and then return to domestic issues. And I think that something over the summer, obviously, you know, the fall of Mosul, the fall of Tikrit, the idea that these guys are sweeping through Iraq in a much more decisive way, you know, just turned things around inside his White House, and even before the beheadings. The beheadings obviously added to that, but I think that was before that happened.
I think the UN speech itself was very, very important. I mean, this is such a contrast to, say, the West Point speech that was only a few months ago that talked about disengaging from the world. The president stood in front of the world community and asserted the U.S. has a leading role in the Middle East, and he asserted the doctrine of preemption, which says we're going after threats before they arise. And he talked, it was really a moment of continuity, because this is not the Bush foreign policy. This is American foreign policy for this foreseeable future. It's not the result of some ideology. It's the result of the briefing he gets every morning, which is scary. And I think that it's good to have that continuity.
Well, I mean, I basically think the president had no choice here. I mean, you can't have Americans beheaded on television and not make some response to it, whether that solves the problem or not. I think, number one, you have to have a response to that, to let the American people know that, no, we're not going to stand for this.
I think that Peter makes an important point. The tipping point of needing to have American action actually came before the beheadings. The beheadings gave him the kind of public and political space to do what I think he understood needed to be done before that. I think the critical question, and Kim kind of alludes to this, is going forward, what then? What if this air campaign doesn't work? The generals are all telling us you cannot get to success in Syria solely from the air, so we are going to stand up this now notional force. What happens a year from now? A year from now, everybody understands the problem will still be there. But what if ISIS has expanded in a year from now, expanded into Jordan, expanded into Turkey? Where will we be? And that's a question that the president has not adequately answered.
And our allies are worried about that, Bob. I was in New York this week for the UN General Assembly events, and I ran into an official in the government of one of these Arab coalition partners. And I said to him, how long are you guys in this for? And he gave me a kind of crossways look and said, how long are you guys in this for? Yeah. They don't entirely trust us. They don't entirely trust our resolve. I will say, Bob, though, I think we are seeing, it's kind of a cliche, but I really do think we've seen a mission creep play out here. Remember, this started out, that first speech from the president, a humanitarian intervention to save the Yazidi on the mountain and protect Erbil. Then it was about freeing the Mosul Dam. Then we started hearing about the Haditha Dam. Now we're striking Syria, ISIS in Syria. There's also another group now, Khorasan in Syria. Well, no ground ground troops, well-defined ground troops. Would that mean special forces on the guy doing spotting? Now we're hearing about a buffer zone, a no-fly zone. So where is it headed? It feels very improvised and open-ended. At the same time, we do have allies worrying that we're not going to follow through.
I know this morning that Tony Blinken said we're not going to repeat a ground invasion in the Middle East. But, I mean, that the question, though, is ground troops. Look, the nature of this strike has already changed just in the past week, in that when you've got armored personnel carriers you can target, it's one thing. When people are blending into the crowds, you have to have people on the ground that are gathering intelligence and directing strikes and special operations teams that are going to take out terrorists. And I don't know how he keeps that promise, in particular with his own military saying that he's going to have to get there at some point.
Well, I mean, it seems to me the president has to do whatever is necessary. If there, you know, if there is a credible threat and they make the evaluation that this is threatening the homeland of the United States, then the president has to be prepared to do that.
Well, but it may be that a President Clinton or a President Cruz or somebody is going to have to do that presidential thing and take, I hope it doesn't come to that, but whatever might be the necessary steps to take the next step. You call it mission creep. I just might call it important steps for the national defense, and we need to be prepared.
But
for
also,
that.
We should keep a sense of proportionality here. I think there's been an understandable emotional revulsion toward ISIS after we saw those beheading videos. But Al Qaeda in Yemen, Al Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula, and also as we've seen these Khorasan guys who are part of the Al Qaeda core based in Pakistan, they're still coming at us. And actually, I think if something, God forbid, were to happen tomorrow, I would think it would be likelier that it would be Al-Qaeda in Yemen rather than ISIS. So let's just keep a sense of proportion.
Part of your previous panel, Bob, had mentioned the distinction between Iraq and Syria. The border is gone, but our approach is different in each of these places because we don't have a ground force in Syria to work with the way we do in Iraq. The Iraqi army has proved to be quite dysfunctional, but there is at least an army there to work with and a government that we're now allied with. In Syria, we have the Free Syrian Army, a group of supposedly moderate opposition figures. And the truth is, you know, they have not been effective. The president himself said it was a fantasy to think that we could arm them and they would be an effective ground force. Okay, what happens if that fantasy then doesn't work? And we run out of targets that we can see from the air, as Kim was talking about, not having spotters on the ground.
Let me just ask you about the political fallout from this. Do any of you think this will be an issue in these fall congressional campaigns? Because Speaker Boehner said this morning, if the president wants a vote on this, he said, I'll be happy to call everybody back to Washington and vote on it. But as we all know, Congress, turned tail and ran home.
I think he's pretty confident.
At the first available opportunity. Yeah, they don't want to be on the record on this.
No.
And it's only, I'll be happy to come, but only if he asks. And the president says, I would welcome a vote, but only if you guys go first. I think the person who really deserves a lot of credit this morning is Senator Tim Kaine, who, first of all, took on his own president of his own party, saying he doesn't have the necessary authority and he needs to call Congress back to do it. And then he took on his colleagues for being feckless and not standing up to their own constitutional responsibilities. But I think the short version of it, in terms of effect on the midterm, not.
But I think it's likely to be very marginal. There could be some rallying effect. There could be some dispiriting of anti-war Democrats. That's
wait,
a significant
in what states,
portion.
Though?
Yeah, no, that's true. It's hard to measure. I think it's likely to be marginal. This does help, though, internationalist candidates in the 2016 run-up. Hillary Clinton is one of them, by the way, who was right on Syria and has told everyone that's true. But it also doesn't help somebody like Rand Paul, who a year ago could talk about drones and NSA, and now he has to sound like Ronald Reagan, which he does not sound like Ronald Reagan.
I think, though, in deciding that they were going to push this past the midterm has actually created a bigger political problem, which we're going to address not 2 years from now, but in fact in December in the lame duck. And it's going to be a real problem because you're going to have the president's anti-war left members of Congress who were reluctant to do this anyway. They now will not have the pressure of an election to sort of push them along behind the president either. And you have his promises of no ground troops, and he's going to be wanting more authority possibly at that point. And there could be a very huge and ugly debate that could not go his way in the end.
A huge and ugly debate, but a really healthy debate. Look at what happened happened in Great Britain this week.
But just looking past the midterms, you mentioned the NSA. This was topic A for us for so long a few months ago, and we're not hearing about it now. And I think that effort is very much on hold, and the people in support of much more aggressive surveillance feel like things have the tide has turned their way very much.
Here's the other way it can affect the midterm elections. It's taken the president's domestic agenda off the radar screen, right? He wanted to spend this fall talking about the minimum wage, about pay equity, about issues that might galvanize particularly women voters and get Democrats to the polls. He's not going to be able to get that message through at a time when we're focused on beheadings and airstrikes.
Let me just, you mentioned 2016. Let me inject here. One of the possible candidates in 2016 is Hillary Clinton, and she became a grandma last night. Ruth?
Well, first of all, congratulations to all the Clintons and Ms. Vinskys. What I thought is most fascinating about this is the degree to which she and Grandpa Bill have publicly embraced grandparenthood. You have a little bit of, well, you know, will she be a grandma or will she be a presidential candidate? Let's be serious. She's running for president. Having a grandchild doesn't make it less likely that she's running for president. And I would argue that having a granddaughter makes it more likely she's running for president. She does not want to be explaining to 10-year-old Charlotte that grandma could have been president but decided to help mommy help stay home and change diapers. I don't think so. She's running.
Does anybody think Hillary Clinton is not going to run for president?
I wouldn't put money on that.
And you can be president and still change diapers.
Let's get
they
back
do it all the time. It's called Congress.
Let's talk about something else involving the White House. An absolutely stunning story in the Washington Post this morning about back in 2011 when somebody fired 7 shots at the White House, and obviously a deranged person from down on the ellipse. The people, the Secret Service agents on top of the White House, the ones there, thought that the shots had hit the White House. It turned out that the president's children were there. The president and his wife were not there. And then suddenly a mysterious call comes over the Secret Service line saying, everybody stand down. There were no shots. And then for 4 days, the Secret Service put out a story that there were stray shots because there was apparently an exchange of gunfire between 2 gangs. Later, a White House maid discovered that one of the windows in the White House had been shot out 4 days after that. And they finally got to investigating this. What are we to make of this?
Well, one thing we make of this is that the Secret Service has profited for many, many years, and our presidents as well, by the myth of invulnerability. The myth of infallibility, in fact. And the idea that the Secret Service can be on top of every situation is, in fact, not true. And we've seen it again with the fence jumper with the knife. In this case, the Secret Service felt it was a very confused situation. He was firing from 700 yards away. They didn't think it was involved at first. As you say, it took 4 days for them to find out. Interestingly, about the story in Ruth and Michael's paper today by Carol Lenig, a great story, it talks about how the president and the first lady themselves were angry, not just at the failures that night to recognize the threat, but to even tell them later on that they had found the bullet, the bullets that had hit the White House. So that was a point of stress between the president and the people who protect him, which is obviously always a dangerous and a difficult situation.
What concerns me, Bob, is that the inevitable response to this is to remove the American people even further from being able to literally see their government. So we now have a new fence at the White House. You're getting moved further and further back. You can't get in. It's difficult to get into the Capitol. It's difficult to see the White House. We need to figure out a way to both prioritize protecting the president and the first family and to make sure that we're not just living in a fortress Pennsylvania Avenue situation.
Well, you know, I mean, it breaks my heart to see some. I don't want this story to be true. I don't want it to. I've known these Secret Service agents all the way back to the Johnson and Kennedy administration. They are brave men and women. They have devoted their life. They're willing to put their lives on the line. But something's going to have to be done here. This is a bureaucracy that it seems to me is just going to have to find some way to fix itself, or somebody's going to have to fix it, and it's not fixed yet.
That may be true. We should also remember crazy things like this have been happening at the White House for a long time. So for people who are hearing these stories and may feel like suddenly there's this influx, there's a lot of attention being paid now. But there was a gunman who fired shots at the Clinton White House circa 1994, and also around that time,
a man crashed a small plane into the White House,
very small, a Cessna, basically crumpled up and did no damage. So you're just never going to be able to do, and you're never going to be able to solve the problem that the White House is a target of sorts for crazy people. And I think you just minimize the risk as much as you can while having a balance of some access to the public. And I think we're actually in a fairly good place right now, actually.
I think that being said, there is a lot of reports out there about an agency that is under stress. It is undermanned. People are overworked. You hear about people coming into their out in a field office in Cleveland. They're supposed to come do a couple of weeks in Washington. They're here for months.
Well, their budget's been cut.
And then also the bigger issue, which you talk about, which is maybe not always being exactly fulsome with things that have happened, which seems to be the bigger concern, because there has to be absolute trust there between that agency and those that they protect. So it seems like there has to be some sort of huge investigation and kind of a top-to-bottom review of how you fix this. Maybe this is a moment.
Michael Gerson, the other big issue that almost is getting, well, it's not getting the attention it deserves because of, you know, we've gone to war here, and that's Ebola.
Right, exactly.
Where are we on that?
Well, right now, the disease has not spread to Nigeria and other places as was feared. So we have a disease that is largely contained, but absolutely catastrophic in the countries where it is now. You could have, the CDC had an estimate this week of a worst case scenario of 1.4 million infections. That's not likely, but you could see hundreds of thousands of infections that would essentially break these countries. The response of the world has been significant and late. Probably should have acted 2 months ago. U.S. military action that the president announced is not likely to be in place for 4 to 8 weeks as we're having exponential increases in infection. And he pleaded at the U.N. This week for other countries to join this effort. So we have a huge humanitarian challenge here. This is not likely to spread to New York or Paris. We know how to control a disease like this. But it is catastrophic in the areas where it is now.
And it could be worse, but it's not likely to spread. But the nightmare scenario is that it mutates and becomes more easily transmittable. For instance, it's not transmittable through the air. But it's possible it would mutate and that would happen. And we have obsessed in this country for more than a decade about terrorists with a weapon of mass destruction. And part of what President Obama is trying to do now is to counter radicalization around the world, kill radicalization at its roots. We need a better public health infrastructure, particularly in a place like Africa, to make sure that we don't have Ebola doesn't, in fact, turn into a weapon of mass destruction that could devastate this country.
Ebola or other health threats.
Many other diseases.
All right. We have to stop there. Thank you all so much. We'll be back in a minute to say thank you to one of baseball's greats. With so many bad examples that we've had to report on lately, we couldn't leave you today without a shout-out to a good guy, Derek Jeter, whose retirement this week reminded us that nice guys do finish first. 5 World Series rings, 14 times an All-Star, but just as important, someone who conducted himself off and on the field in a way that made thousands of little ball players want to grow up to be just like him. I've never met him, but I'd like to say thanks, Derek. Today's guests were Deputy National Security Advisor Tony Blinken, Virginia Senator Tim Kaine, and former Deputy CIA Director Mike Moret. The executive producer of Face the Nation is Mary Hager. The senior producer is Rob Hinden. This broadcast was directed by Sue Ann Stocky Wayne. Face the Nation originates from CBS News in Washington. For more Face the Nation, we're online at facethenation.com, and you can follow Face the Nation and CBS Radio News on Twitter, Google+, and Facebook.